All right, alchemists, here we are. Episode 3 on the way with Melissa here shortly. I really enjoyed getting to meet Melissa over Zoom. She's such an incredible person with a really good story and rooted in the why behind her decision-making process and really starts to unpack the data-driven process behind her decisions. So as you listen today, I really hope you're considering how you, as a leader, as an educator, as somebody in any role, are using the information around you to make and guide your decisions. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy episode 3.
This is the Elemental Educator, the podcast where we kindle the fires of dialogue with the alchemists of education. We're here to embark on a journey where ancient wisdom meets the contemporary world of education. On Elemental Educator, we dive into the deep waters of adaptability, feel the grounding earth of core values, ride the swift winds of change, and ignite the fiery spirit of risk-taking. Fire, earth, wind, water. This is the Elemental Educator, and now your host, Tyler Como.
All right, alchemists, welcome back to another episode of Elemental Educator. I'm so excited to be here today with Melissa Donnie. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are, well, I am. I'm so excited for this conversation just to connect with people around the world, and I'm so happy we linked up. So, Melissa, I know a little bit about you, but I don't think the listeners know a ton about you. And to be honest, I don't know a ton about you. So I would love to hear your story. So where you're at in education now and how you got there.
So, gosh, I feel like I've been in education my entire life because when I was young, I did lots of summer camp and I was always involved in some way working with kids that were younger than I was. And then when I went to college, my career, my job while I was in college was working in a preschool that was in a church down the street from where I went to college. So then I knew pretty early on that I wanted to be an educator and that I wanted to teach elementary. So I came out, when I got out of school, I did a student teaching in second grade and I thought, this is where I want to be. I want to be in second grade. Rewind just a little bit. I did a few years of pre-K in a school, in a public school, charter actually. And then I also did my student teaching there in second grade. And I knew I wanted to stay in that school and that I wanted to stay in second grade. And then my now sister-in-law was teaching fourth grade at that school as well. And she said they wanted to interview me for a fourth grade position. Having done pre-K my entire life, that was a little daunting because I just felt like the younger kids were really my bread and butter. And then I interviewed for the second grade position with all the teachers that I had just student taught with, and they did not choose me, which was a little bit like, okay, kind of really couldn't figure out why. I never really did ask them why, but the fourth grade team really wanted me to be a part of their team. So I started teaching fourth grade. I did that for most of my teaching career. That was from 2009 until we moved around a lot, my husband and I. So I've done mostly fourth grade. I've done 1 year of PE. I did a year of kinder. And that was when I realized that I really did enjoy the older kids and wanted to stay on the older upper elementary end. Now this year I'm in fifth grade and I actually took 3 years out of the classroom because I thought I was done. I just felt like I've met my limit and I think that I'm done. And so I took 3 years out and then ended up going back in the 22-23 school year. So just last year.
Wow. And so currently grade 5.
Yes.
Yeah. There is so much to unpack there.
Yeah, and a lot.
I love your start point where you said you did summer camps, because that's where I started actually. I did summer camps as well, and I ran, it was tennis, and then it turned into multi-sport, and then I brought it into schools, and that's how I fell in love with education. So what kind of camp were you a part of, and why did you, we're going maybe just 2 years
back,
right? We're not going to age you. No, we're going only like 2 years back here. But what got you started with those camps?
So I was in high school at the time, and the middle school where I attended school, I was still pretty close. My brother is 4 years younger than me. So he was in middle school, still in contact with all these same teachers. I played volleyball throughout middle school, all the way through high school. And so my coach was one of the counselors, I guess you could say, at the camp that was run through the middle school. So it was just a summer camp where they took field trips and did things on school grounds. And he asked me if I wanted to volunteer to be one of the counselors. So I did it strictly on a volunteer basis. And I did that every year while I was in high school because I was still in contact with all those people that had coached me or taught me in middle school.
That's amazing. So just through contacts, you got into it. And do you find that things that you were doing in that camp translated to how you run your classroom?
Not at all, because quite honestly, as a high school student, I just wanted to be involved in that way. I wanted to help out these people who had mentored me all the way through middle school that I loved and trusted. And I really just wanted to help them out. And I did enjoy it. But I didn't, the odd thing was, I didn't really feel like this is the direction I'm definitely going to head. I just knew that I really liked what I was doing.
Right. Which is very, very unique, because there's some subtleties in there, because you really liked to help out the people that were there for you. And that's kind of why we are teachers, right? We like to help out the kids that are there for us as well. So some similarities and some connections there. You talked as well about a lot of change, right? You moved around a lot. Was it all within the same state or within the same town, school setting, or were we bouncing around from different locations even?
So different locations. The only time I was born and raised the first 10 years of my life in Pennsylvania, and then my family moved to Florida, which is where I am now. And I had lived here my whole life from the time I was 10. He and I moved to Georgia for 15 months. And then we were like, this is not, no. So we came back to Florida. So yeah, when we met, we'd actually known each other since middle school. But when we reconnected and became a couple, he was in chiropractic school. He had already gone, he was 21 years in the military, a whole career there, and then decided to go back to school and get a doctorate. So he was in chiropractic school. And when we moved to the same town, it was very much under the just know I'm not staying here. This is just while I'm in chiropractic school. And so when he graduated, we left. That's when we went to Georgia. Then we came back and we were in Tallahassee. And then we moved to where we are now. But even before that, before we lived in the Daytona area together, I had moved to two different schools in the town that I grew up in. So I've moved schools 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Six times, seven times.
Wow.
Since 2011.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is
very
a lot.
Difficult.
And there's so much more that I just want to keep unpacking there, because you actually touch on something about risk taking and change that's very powerful. And it comes back to your brief conversation you just mentioned there about you just being there for chiropractor school and then moving. That transparency, that communication. So when that schooling ended, it probably made the change of moving again and the risk taking a lot easier, because you already had that expectation on what was happening.
It did, but reflecting back on my teaching career, besides where I am now, that school that I worked in was my favorite place I ever worked. I had the most amazing experience, and I was there for 3 years. And even though I knew that that time was going to be limited, it was pretty devastating for me. And then we moved to Georgia, where I took on kindergarten just to get my foot in the door. And that was one of the two hardest years I've ever had.
So let's start with what made it so fun and so easygoing in that first position?
I had an administrator. Actually, I had a principal and an assistant principal at that school that were very much on the same page. They worked very well together. That particular district I worked in moved admin around a lot. It was almost like as soon as they got comfortable, then they ripped one of those admin away and put them in another school. During that time that I worked for them, their whole teaching philosophy just really aligned with the way I felt a classroom should operate. And they took me to the Ron Clark Academy in Atlanta. I don't know if you're familiar with that school.
No.
Oh, goodness. That's a whole nother podcast. But that school is basically, it's in the inner city of Atlanta. They built it on purpose in the most troubled area of the city. And it's a privately funded school. So it's all donations. But there they take every Friday, they have 300 plus teachers that come and do professional development in their school. And so they sit in their classrooms and they watch everything. And it's just, it would take me forever to tell you, but just the way that they teach. And so then they kind of brought that back to our school and we transformed our school. And I would say that that environment was probably the most trusting environment I'd ever worked in, because my principal was just very much like, I trust you. You have full autonomy to do whatever you think is necessary for the benefit of your students. And I haven't really felt that since I worked for her.
Okay. So you're there in that moment, though, and you go and experience this totally different system, and you make a decision, and your leadership team makes a decision that we're going to bring this back to our school. How did they just flip a switch and start bringing that change into that building?
We saw a lot in that day trip that we were there. When they decided they were going to take some of us to that school, the first year, it was kind of spur of the moment, and there we didn't have the budget to send a large number of teachers. We were actually doing a book study from the man who founded the school. We were reading one of his books, and my principal had it signed. And she said, whoever gets the signed copy will go with myself, my assistant principal, and our school counselor. And I drew that book. So I ended up going with the three of them to the school. Then the following year, they got funds to send just a large group of teachers. But to answer your question, we learned so much that it was very overwhelming. So we had like a PD where we presented everything we had seen and learned to the entire staff. And then as a staff, we decided these are the things that we'll try to implement first, because there was so much. And so the first thing we did, because all their classrooms are painted to reflect their personality and designed. And so the first thing we did was she allowed us all to paint our classrooms however we wanted to.
Oh, wow.
With no permission from the superintendent, and just was like, I'll ask for forgiveness because we're doing it.
So that's a big risk too. Wow. And so there's actually two pieces there that help that change happen. And the first is using their system to burst your bubbles. And by having you go there and bring other people there and see it in action, right? You're getting the validation that this is something that works. And then the second part is there was a conscious decision made to tackle this in small steps and break it down and go piece by piece, starting with something like painting our rooms, mm-hmm. right? That's so, so interesting to unpack there. However, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows, because you had that shift and you made that move. Right. And you end up going somewhere that's not desirable for you in that kindergarten room in that new place in Georgia. Right. But we had to get through it. So how did we go about accepting that undesirable change and working through it?
I had accepted the position prior to us moving. So that was good. And then when we got there and I started, I remember feeling very much like a fish out of water, because my environment in terms of my classroom is I don't have a lot of desks in my room. I have flexible seating. I was one of the only teachers who did that in my previous school. And this particular principal at this school was very skeptical, because he was very traditional and I had kindergarten. So he was very skeptical in the sense of like, he didn't trust that I would be able to teach my five-year-olds how to properly treat this furniture and how to, because that was essentially my classroom management, the use of that seating. So I did it on a smaller scale, but he made me draw a map of what my vision was and made sure that I sent my research that I had done on how that room was going to function to my parents. So initially, I felt a lot less freedom to do what I thought was best for my class. And that was a struggle for a while. But what I ended up having to do was kind of, I had a paraprofessional that was with me all day, and she was like my right arm. She was amazing and went along with anything that I wanted to do, but my principal, not so much. So in order to adapt to that, I just had to be willing to sit down with him and share with him not only the what, but the why the things I wanted to do would work for my classroom and how I was going to manage that. And so it was difficult, because it was a lot less of feeling like I was trusted as I had in my previous school. But I also knew that those kindergartners, that I was there for a reason. He picked me for kindergarten for a reason, and that I just needed to make sure that I did whatever I had to do for those kids. And it was difficult, and it was just a day by day thing. And then ironically, I went to him at the end of the year and I said to him, if you can move me to fourth grade, I would really appreciate that. And he moved me. And then that October was when we found out we were moving again.
Oh.
So he moved me like I asked him to. And 3 months in, we had to go.
You packed up, yeah. And that whole dynamic you just explained, it's a demonstration between the importance of building trust and moving from transactional leadership to transformational leadership and adaptive leadership, and giving you the creativity in your classroom. You were able to get some of it, and you would see that result in some way, shape, or form. But you actually mentioned something really powerful. And I don't know if you're a Simon Sinek fan, but he talks about a concept of people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And you talked about breaking down the why behind things. And so when you talk about how you go about your classroom, how do you go about making sure when you're changing or when you're implementing change that people know the why?
That's a good question. I think it depends on the people. Who are the people I'm explaining the why to? The first thing that always takes place, my classroom is built on relationships and nothing more. At the beginning of the year, as an example, I have a no homework policy. And my students, of course, are like, what? No homework, you know? But you do have a lot of parents who want to know why. Why do you not assign homework? Don't they need homework as practice? So that's something that I had to explain to my parents, why I don't believe in homework and why the research I have done proves that at the elementary level, it's not effective. So I think for me, it depends on who I'm giving my why to. Is it my admin? Is it my parents? Is it my coworkers? I have to do that with all of those people. You know, sometimes I have to justify people walk into my classroom and they're like, wow, your class is so spacious. It's so cool. But then the next thing they say is, I would never do that with my kids.
Why and not? Then,
exactly. Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is it is extra work. It's extra work to teach them how to still be students and not have to be confined to a desk. It's still work. Responsibility to get up and move to a new seat if you are distracted where you are. That's hard.
Yeah, it's so refreshing to hear that. And I just had a conversation with that Idaho teacher who referenced,
I love her.
And we spiraled back to this concept of emotional engagement before cognitive engagement. And what you're explaining, your flexible seating, when we really get down to the why, when we talk to parents or we talk to administrators and we have to explain why we're doing things, we're doing them because it's best for kids. And the decision on why it's best for kids comes back to, we need to engage them emotionally to then move to behavioral engagement, to then move to our cognitive engagement, right? And I can't even get to cognitive engagement if my kids don't feel comfortable or safe in my classroom. And what's the best way? One of the best, most obvious ways to make people feel safe and comfortable in your classroom, flexible seating. Let them be where they want to be in your room. So you're there until October, you shift, you keep moving. We have change. We go from, you know, our grade four to kindergarten to grade four to grade five to school. We have all of these changes happening. What did you learn from that you actually now bring into your classroom?
I have a lot of life conversations with my students. They know my whole college career story because that's a whole nother story I didn't even tap into. They know what I went through as a college student and how I'm going to date myself, but how I actually went to college right out of high school and didn't finish. And didn't go back and get my bachelor's until the day before I turned 35 years old. I have shared that story with them and all the change from the beginning of my life all the way through all the schools I've been to. We talk about all the things I have learned through that, how you have to be able to adapt. You have to be able to be willing to ask people for help. You have to be willing, all those things that all those life skills that you learn from making all those changes that you don't even realize you learn until there's a life lesson that you can teach your students. And we have those conversations all the time. I always relate to them in, I understand how you feel. And this is my own experience. This is how and why I understand exactly what you're trying to tell me. I don't know that there's any one thing that I take into my classroom. It's everything. Everything I've gone through, having to make all those changes and being the new person at a school, what felt like every single year, every year or two, I was in a different school last year than I am this year. And so I tell them all the time, especially because now we have those talks about middle school approaching. How am I going to handle that? You know, what that's so scary. And I think it's just being able to help them through life by teaching them life skills through my own experiences.
And I love the message that it doesn't matter where you're at in your stage of life, you can make a change happen. Mm-hmm. So whether it's going back to school at 35 or whether it's starting something new tomorrow, it's that step you can take, that small step you can take to just start the change process. It's that freezing, unfreezing, and refreezing cycle. Along that way, and by the way, it's so good to hear that you bring in the idea that it's okay to ask questions, to be transparent, because whenever I go about change, like you, I'm in a new building this year. I was in a different building last year. I was in a different building before that. And if we go back 3 years, I was in a different building before that too. And move is, you know, change is constant. Change is the only permanent thing that will always happen. We'll always have to face it. And we don't have to face it alone. We just have to ask questions. We have to seek information. And that's the best way to overcome it. I love how that's influenced your classroom and how you inspire kids to ask those questions, because they see change every day in their classrooms. They see it through lessons when they're learning new material. That's change.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they have,
definitely.
Yeah, and they have the confidence at that point to start asking those questions. Along that way, did any of these lessons that you've learned that you've started to instill in your classroom in these holistic views, how many of them, or do you have a story of any of them that went the hard way the first time?
I mean, how many times did I learn the hard way? The things that I've said in the heat of the moment with kids, not that I talk nasty to my kids, but and it always takes them time to get to know me, but they know that I love them, but I'm snarky. And my kids are snarky, especially my group this year. So we get each other and I know what kids I can play with and what kids I can't, you know? Okay. The first thing that comes to mind is when I was working my first year as a fourth grade teacher, my very first year.
It's always in the first year. Yeah.
But I was in the same school that I had been in 2 years prior. It was where I did my student teaching and where I taught pre-K. So people knew me. And I don't remember what my kids were irritated about. I don't remember what they were complaining about, whining about. It could have been any number of things. And all I remember is saying, I don't even know if I can say it. All I remember is saying to them, "Oh, tough titty," said the kitty when the milk ran out. And the kids were like,
You guys can't see, but she's covering faces and wide-eyed looking at the camera.
And I was not married at the time. My last name was Banger. And my kids are like, "Miss Banger." And I'm like, "I, you guys wouldn't stop." And I snapped, "I'm sorry. Please don't tell anyone." So then they're like, We're not going to say anything. So then I said, in my mind, I was like, "I'm going to tell them myself. I have to, because somebody's going to repeat it either outside to someone else, or they're going to go home and tell their parents. And I have to face it." So my kids were at this particular school, it was all on the outside. So my door had a huge glass pane on it, window pane that you could see out. My kids were in the music room, which was like, right, you could look out my window and see them coming out. So they're coming out. And I told them, "I'm going to tell," my principal's name was Mr. Sternberg. I said, I'm going to tell Mr. Sternberg, "Don't tell him, he's going to fire you." So ironically enough, he's coming around this side of my building while my kids are walking this way. So I reach out and I'm like, "Come here." So he comes in and they're all at the window going, "Don't do it," waving their arms. And so I tell him what I said and he laughs and he says, "Okay, do you want to mess with your kids?" And I'm like, "I would love to mess with my kids." And he says, "Okay." What he said to me was, "Well, you had a good run. You're halfway through your third year here. It was a good run." And so he said, I'm going to tell the kids that I fired you. Like, we're going to just go." I'm like, "Okay." So I open the door to let my kids in. And as they're filing in, he's like, "I'm sorry, Miss Banger, you got to get your stuff and go. You cannot talk like that in the classroom. It's unforgivable. Get your things." And my kids start to cry. So he's like, I'm kidding, because they're all like melting down. But funny story, yes. But in the moment, I was like, "Oh my God." Not that it was a horrible thing that I said, but you realize how many things you might say in normal life that you can't say in the classroom because somebody's going to take it wrong. Somebody's going to tell somebody. So I don't know if that's necessarily what you're looking for, but
that's great. And
it jumped out to me because I definitely learned the hard way. You've got to control your emotions.
Wow. And it reinforces too, that we're human and we make mistakes and we need to laugh at those mistakes. But all I can hear when I hear that story is your principal must have had such a good connection and tap into his school to know that he could do that and it would still be okay, right? Yeah. And to get that response from those kids, that emotional response, one, that's probably a good feeling for you. It made you feel valued because they definitely cared for you in that moment and you would have built that trust. But two, it demonstrates the power, and you at that point, you probably recognize the impact you really have on their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
It's something so powerful. Thank you for being vulnerable and sharing. I love I love that story. Can you repeat the phrase one more time?
You're really going to make me.
Okay. Absolutely.
"Tough titty," said the kitty when the milk ran out.
And I love that you had to lean into your computer to say that again. That just cracks me up. That's so good. Okay, so I want to shift a little bit here, because we've talked so much about change. We've talked about the communication, the needing to be transparent, the starting with small steps, and to just put your feet in and take that risk regardless of where you're at and see where things go. But there's more to your story than just talking about change from that standpoint. You are a data-driven math expert, and I would love to hear how you're using data to drive your pedagogical practice within math.
So currently we're beginning to think about and start intervention groups to prepare our kids for our state test. And we're trying to do it in a way that also provides, because true intervention is a small group of kids, right? This is not a small group, because we've taken the entire fifth grade and split them based on what they need. So what we did was we took their scores. We kind of thought to ourselves, okay, these kids are borderline proficient, so we're going to put them in a group to push them forward. And then we have a group of our kids that are like extension kids that are already at or above proficiency. And then we have a group of kids who are below proficiency. They don't know that they're grouped that way, but they come. Some of the classes have 20 to 25 kids, so it's a full class size. So what we did was we had to go through, which was a very tedious task, and we took every question, every standard that they had a question on. The state of Florida breaks our state test up into three tests. So it's a progress monitoring tool. So instead of the one large test at the end of the year that we used to do, it's three tests throughout the year, September, December, and in May. And at the beginning of the year, they're tested on, it's cumulative. It's everything they have to know as a fifth grader, and they know none of it. And then they take it in December when they've learned about half of what they have to know, and then again in March. So we took that data, we pulled out all of the standards, which kids got it right, which kids got it wrong. And we are kind of going back to the beginning and going over things that we did the very first start of school. It's like an intervention, but it's more of like a review. We're starting to review content on top of the content that we're still teaching. And I mean, that's a bit on a big scale. But then within the walls of just my two classes that I see for math, I do exit tickets, which is data, you know, piles of this one gets it, this one's almost there, this one doesn't, which is data. And that's how I formulate my small groups. I do a lot of like informal checks where kids write things on a whiteboard, they hold it up, and I can see who gets it and who doesn't. I think that teachers think data always has to be on a spreadsheet. I have to be that teacher who's good at putting my data on a spreadsheet. When you don't, it should drive your instruction all day, every day. And it can be as easy as you write something on a board, you look at it and you take a note, this one doesn't have it. And you group your kids accordingly. It's infused in everything I do in my classroom.
And our decision-making process should be data-driven. And when we reflect back on the whys, usually our whys are related because our data is informing us to make a decision, mm-hmm. right? And what you explain at the start when you're talking about that whole group review, that holistic approach and breaking down those strands, I would actually classify it as tier one intervention. It's a universal support. It's something meant for everybody. And you're not actually reaching that tier two, tier three intervention because you're not needing to do the pullout because everybody needs that tier one. Mm-hmm. So we're just giving it to everybody. So thank you for sharing that. I love how you're using data, and that message is so powerful that it's not just a spreadsheet. It's simple check and reflex. It's walking around. It can be observations, right? We get into that whole idea of assessment, and even in our classrooms, the formative, the summative, the of and for learning and as learning, right? All of this is data that we take in and then make decisions off of. How do you see data informing your practice beyond that? So you're doing these exit tickets. You're talking about kids being high or low. Are you unpacking that at a deeper level and wondering why are they not getting that if that's there?
Yes. So one of the things that I have implemented in my classroom that I honestly wasn't really doing before is making my math block more of less me and more them. So I've been giving them a problem every day, and I use an app called Braining Camp, and it's manipulatives, all kinds of manipulatives that they can move around. You can write on your screen. And so I give my kids a problem, and I have recently taught them how everyone is a different type of math learner. You have your concrete learner, you have your abstract learner, and you have those who draw pictures, those who need models and use manipulatives, and those who understand the numbers. So what I have done is I have kind of taken it back a step with those kids that I know are not understanding it just by looking at the numbers. They don't have that abstract understanding. And so what I'm doing ever since January, I have dialed it all the way back and pulled out my manipulatives and given them to all my kids to help them solve problems. Because what I found was a concrete learner picks it up that way. An abstract learner has a hard time using a manipulative because they think abstract. So it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge for my higher kids too, because they've had to find another way. If they can solve it with the numbers, then I tell them, now I want you to find another way. And so I've taught them how to draw a picture, how to use manipulatives, depending on what it is we're doing. My abstract learners already know how to use numbers. So I have noticed a shift because I have started with my kids who maybe don't have quite the same understanding with the manipulatives. And then I said, okay, so now if you're testing and you don't have use of those manipulatives, how are you going to solve it? And teaching them to draw a picture. And then eventually, or maybe not, but they can still draw a picture, teaching them how to find it with numbers. And since I have taken that approach, I've noticed that some of those kids who probably felt as though they were floundering, even though I was supporting them, no longer feel that way because I have finally put something in their hands that's useful, that helps, makes them feel like they understand what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, in contrast, they're flourishing. I always struggle with the idea of, if we're going to give kids manipulatives, why can't we use them on our tests? Why can't we use them in life, right? And it's a tool in our toolbox. We should be proud that we have more tools. We actually make a point too. It doesn't matter which class we're in, whether it's our math or social or English or science, we intentionally start classes with highly engaged problem-solving starters. So in our math, we use a website called SD Mysteries, and it goes through a guesstimation process. Yeah, okay, so we know what
it is. I just stumbled on that. Wait a minute. Oh no, I went to a training, and I went to a math professional development, and they told us about that.
Right, and it's incredible, and they gear it for proper age groups, and it doesn't matter which one, there's a day of the week. The New York Times graphs, the New York Times pictures, right? Going to B-Riddles and giving kids riddles to solve for science to get their claim evidence and reasoning behind it. Starting off before you get into your content with that highly engaging problem-solving process teaches kids how to problem solve, and then they can get into it on their own and be a bit more independent, and they can build that resiliency behind it.
I mean, that is the biggest problem. It's not the seeing the problem and knowing what to do when it's just numbers. It's problem solving.
Yeah.
The word problem is always an issue. And when they see it, they don't even know where to begin. Ever since I started doing that, a problem at the beginning, I want you to solve it your way, whatever that is. And then I just can kind of go around and help the kids that I know are going to need my support when I do that.
Right. And even that line between, you know, problem solving is tough, but the comprehension, right? And so really building that capacity to know what those words mean. So we're in our classroom, we are implementing all of these activities, we're collecting data, you're finding out if it's working, if it's not working. What opportunities do you have for kids to actually reflect on their own data and determine, is this working for me or not working for them?
So I have regular data chats with my kids. Sometimes that looks like iReady is a digital platform that the kids take a diagnostic at the beginning of the year, and that diagnostic places them wherever they are at that point in time. And then iReady knows where they are and provides them what they call my path. So every kid has a path that is unique to them, their strengths and their weaknesses. So iReady, in my opinion, really works to fill the gaps that I may never be able to help fill. So for example, I have a kid in my class who has always been pulled out. This year is his first year in a gen ed classroom all day as a fifth grader. Some of his math is on a first grade level. So he feels like when he goes on iReady, he feels like he can do it because it's giving him what he needs. And he doesn't know that what he needs is different than what the person across my classroom needs. So we use it. We take the diagnostic at the beginning of the year. And so I always share it with them. And I explain to them, this is where you are right now as an incoming fifth grader. And because it breaks down each of the content areas, I'm able to say, this is where you are. Once they see, okay, I'm at a fourth grade level, which makes sense because I just started fifth grade. They're just able to understand where they are when I share that with them. When they took it the second time, I shared that with them. I always make them share with me how they did on a lesson. And they know that if they don't achieve a certain percentage on a lesson, they have to redo that lesson. We have a lot of conversations about where they are and why. And sometimes it's as simple as you understood what you needed to do. You just didn't do it correctly. So here's how we're going to fix it. We have them all the time. And sometimes they're on a very grand scale when we're talking about our state test. And sometimes, like I said, they're just as small as this particular problem. You added wrong, but you did all the other steps correct. So I can tell that you know what you're doing and you just made a silly mistake.
And I'm not sure where it came from, but at some point in education, it became a norm that not sharing information with people was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we're recognizing through many movements and things coming forward that it's a horrible idea. And we need to be transparent, have open, have honest communication. And when you establish that, what you're actually doing is you're creating alignment and you're saying, here's our goal. As an educator, it's always my goal to have a kid grow for a year's worth of progress given a year's worth of input. And mm-hmm. when the kids know that, it doesn't matter what level they're coming in at, it matters the level they're going out at and that progress that was made in between. But to have that realistic transparency and conversation about where are we at and where are we trying to go realistically, why shouldn't we include kids? Why shouldn't we include parents, right? Why are we masking that from them?
Why are they going to put all of their effort into something you're asking them to do if they don't understand why the outcome even matters or why it's important?
Right back to Simon Sinek, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it.
Right.
That's the data-driven person in you that comes out, right? It's the why. So one piece that I want to get to here, and you talked about how where you're at now, ideally, it's not necessarily the best it's been. And it's not necessarily showing an indication of going there right away. Hopefully it gets there for you. But in this moment of time, is even back to where you took that three-year leave and you're debating, is this for me? What got you through it? Where did you turn for your inspiration?
During those 3 years?
Yeah, and where you are now too.
I came out after the 2018-2019 school year. It was the roughest year I had ever had. I taught PE that year. Again, we moved. That was when we left Georgia. On my last school was October 31st. So second week in November, I was just rolling into whatever job I could get to get into the school system. And it was a PE job, the hardest year I'd ever, ever had. And after that year, they offered me a fourth grade position. And when I came home and told my husband, he said, I don't think so. You have been miserable this year, and I don't think it's a PE versus a fourth grade thing. Because I would come home every day. There were fights every single day. I'm only 5'4", and I'm between fifth graders who are up here, and they don't care if I'm in the middle when they're swinging. It was a lot. And my husband was like, no, I think you can look for something else at another school. And I did that year. Tons of things posted. This was when I was in the state capitol, and I'd always been told it's very hard to get into. I interview after interview after interview after interview, and I didn't get any job. So I was like, well, I guess this is my fate for now. So I started teaching through a company called OutSchool, and I was basically allowed to create my own classes, whatever I wanted them to be, and determine what that class would cost per child and kids paid to take my classes. And I did that. And that was great for most of that time. And that was my way of being able to keep doing what I loved, just in a different way. And then last year, I just had, it was very strange because some of the things that are happening in education are extremely frustrating. If it wasn't for my love of my kids, I would have already been done and never gone back. But I just was having this like ache for being in the classroom. I just wanted to be back in the classroom, even though I knew all of the headache I was going to have to deal with that came with that. I wanted to be back in the classroom. And so I guess I never really left teaching. I just left it in the traditional sense until I was like, it's time to go back. I'm ready.
Wow. First, shout out to all of the phys ed teachers, your jobs are incredibly difficult.
Yes, they are.
Just a reminder, I used to
teach phys ed.
Yeah, and the struggle in phys ed is so different from every other class because you're picking fights with kids that just are okay with saying no and all the little fights behind that. But second, it's good recognition on your partner's part and your family dynamics to say, we need to change. That's not working. And to pull away, but that driving back, that inspiration we're getting at, it was your why. It's your kids. It's your love for making an impact on others. So we're hoping that this builds to somewhere. And so, Melissa, where we are now, where do you see this going? What's your future looking like for you?
I have a goal, I would say long term, but I've been in education for a while, so I feel like it's already been long term. Eventually, I want to be either an interventionist or a coach. I have a master's degree in curriculum and instruction. So I want to, math is my passion. I've taught everything, but math is my passion, which is extremely ironic because I was not a good math student. Math did not come easily for me and I didn't understand it, frankly. And now it's my favorite thing to teach. But I eventually want to transition into some type of coach position, maybe long term, maybe even working for a curriculum company, writing a homeschool curriculum. Like, I have lots of ideas floating around in my head because I know as a teacher, the things that I feel like kids don't, I hate to say don't need, but I feel like there are things built in that we are expected to give kids that don't really make any sense to me in terms of curriculum. So I feel like as somebody who knows and understands exactly what kids of a certain age need, I have like a very long-term goal of creating that for parents if they homeschool or maybe even for schools. So I kind of want to like step my way up. I think my first goal is probably definitely a math coach or an interventionist, something along those lines.
I love
that. Really make an impact and help teachers with their kids that are struggling.
And you can almost coach yourself in this scenario because you've done so much change. You've taken so many risks. Mm-hmm. Your small steps, you can just start doing things and putting it out there and seeing where it bites, right? So What a cool journey. And I hope that when we reconnect, who knows, maybe it's next year or 2 years, maybe it's 5 years from now, the story is you're somewhere in that place because that would just be so fulfilling to hear back from you from that.
Yeah, that would be great.
So for people listening, for educators out there, what advice from your lived experience would you give out to people listening right now that are maybe struggling with the change or the spot they're in or how they're going about their decision-making processes?
I really think you just have to embrace change, which is really a mindset, right? It's hard to tell people it's easy to tell people to embrace change. It's not easy to embrace the change. And I didn't always embrace it. I kicked and screamed all the way there. But once I got where we were going, wherever that was at the time, I knew that I had what I was good at to fall back on. I'm not one of those people who thinks I'm good at much, but I know my value as an educator. I know my kids love me and they feel comfortable and they know they can trust me and that I'm there for them no matter what. So even on their worst day or my worst day. And so I think that you really just have to learn to find the positive in that change and know that that change is happening for a reason. And there's probably something coming that you're not even aware of. I told my kids every year as fourth graders, when they would say, will you go with fifth grade with me? My response was always no. And they would say, why? And I would say, because something happens to you the summer between fourth and fifth grade, and I'm not going to like you anymore next year. And we would think about it, you know, and they would be like, that's so mean. And I told my kids that story just today. And they're like, and here you are. It's like, look, yeah, see how lucky you are?
Wow. Yeah. And change is not the enemy.
No.
I look at change. Change is an artist. And it constantly reshapes our life, which is the canvas. And it comes back to the only thing that's permanent is change.
And the weirdest thing, Tyler, about me not wanting to do fifth grade. Now, when I tell you all the things I thought about fifth grade are 1,000% true, they are. They are like possessed by something. I mean, I assume it's the like prepubescent period that they're possessed by. But now, I say all that, but what I really found out was that it isn't difficult like I thought it would be. and I don't hate it. I actually love it. And I would never have known that if I hadn't taken this position. And I had this weird sense of like excitement when I interviewed for it. I didn't even have that like, when she said it was fifth grade and not fourth grade. Again, that was a change I was never going to make ever in my life. And then I did, and I'm so glad I did.
That's so good to hear. So Melissa, we're wrapping up here, but if people want to follow you, get a hold of you, and connect with you, what's the best way for them to do so?
My Instagram. I'm most active on there. I have other forms of social media, but I'm most active on Instagram.
Awesome. Do you want to share your tag with the world here?
Yes, it's at Hello Mrs. Donnie. So Hello MRSDAHNE.
Awesome. And we'll link that into the description when the ad runs. Well, Melissa, this has been amazing. I can't thank you enough for joining me today. I've really enjoyed the conversation, getting to connect and hear your lived experience.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much. It's been so, this is my first official podcast and I'm like, I am beyond excited.
You crushed it. Absolutely.
You've been listening to The Elemental Educator. Our aim is to illuminate optimal educational practices on a global scale. And second, we want to shine a light on the expertise and knowledge that Tyler brings to educational institutions. He's not just a talking head. He's a practicing educator, a school principal, armed with a master's in educational administration, and on the brink of completing his doctorate. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, review, and subscribe. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, find us on Instagram, Facebook, and X at Elemental Educator. And to contact us, fire off an email. See what I did there? Fire off. Okay. Send an email to elementaleducator@gmail.com. See you next time on The Elemental Educator.